Welcome to this week's edition of A Degree of Interest with me, Monique Chambers. And this week I have three guests. I have Nicholas Vella, I have Julia Vassallo-Eminyan, and also Roberto De Mono. Now, we're going to be talking this week about PhDs, which is something that can be quite overwhelming for people. You know, when you see that somebody has a PhD, you're a bit, ooh, they're going to be really clever. How do I? Now, you are very clever. I am actually going to ask you to explain what your PhDs are in. But to start off with, I'm going to speak to Nicholas Vella. So you obviously have a PhD yourself, but also you run a unit here at university. Tell us a bit about your PhD and how you got into running the unit.
Yes, I got my PhD many moons ago, in 1998, having spent 4 years reading for the degree at the University of Bristol in the UK, having completed a first degree at the University of Malta, a bachelor's.
Okay.
It was a PhD in archaeology, because I am an archaeologist by training and now by profession. And it looked at temple sites belonging to the Phoenicians all over the Mediterranean. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the PhD, the research, as much as I did doing this in the UK. And of course, perhaps I did not realize at the time that this would be my only one single opportunity of being able to concentrate on a piece of research without anything else coming in the way. But I completed my PhD when I was 26 years old.
Okay.
And that, of course, makes a difference because I did not have caring responsibilities at the time. I started lecturing here in 1999 after a postdoc in Rome, and of course I was taken up by writing lectures and delivering courses, the doctoral school, which I am a director of, was set up in 2017. It was the brainchild of the present rector, Professor Alfred Vella, who I knew because I sat on many boards of studies chaired by him. And I think because I was constantly nagging him and saying that we should have a support structure for doctoral students, that we might be shortchanging them, that it is good that faculties are doing their best in promoting research and supporting it, etc., etc., but they still needed, we still needed to go the extra bit to do more. And of course, Professor Vella, the rector, knew about this because he had shared a particular committee that managed doctoral affairs, and he vowed to set up a doctoral school if he became rector, which he did. So we've been around for 4 years now. We're entering the fifth year at the moment, and this was unanimously agreed for by Senate as an idea, as a unit, and really and truly it is a support structure for those engaged in doctoral research, i.e. the students, but also academic staff, administrative staff, and also supervisory staff. So essentially what we are doing is we're looking at things which are usually not catered for by the faculty, institute, or center, where the students are doing their research.
So what sort of support do you give them?
Yes, the first thing that we did was create a professional development program for researchers. In other words, the model of a doctoral school has existed in the States for a very long time, since at least the 60s and early 70s. In Europe, it's really over the last 20 years that the idea of a doctoral school was born as part of reforms at the European level. One thing that all doctoral schools do is this professional development program, which looks at providing students with workshops to develop transversal skills, which usually are not catered for by the faculty, although there are many faculties that provide this sort of help anyway, which is very discipline-specific. We look at things which are not discipline-specific. How do you deliver a presentation in 3 minutes? How do you talk about your research in 180 seconds? How do you debate? How do you convince? How do you manage stress and anxiety, which is unfortunately part and parcel of being a researcher? How do you look at conflict resolution? These are the sort of workshops that we have been delivering over the last 4 years, and the feedback from students, but also from the academic supervisors, has been very, very positive. And of course, to deliver these workshops, I draw upon about 60 academics from the university who have agreed to help out, to deliver workshops with students. We had the challenge of the pandemic, so some of them had to be delivered on online, but I am extremely, extremely grateful to my colleagues who are chipping in over and above their normal lecturing duties to help us deliver this this product.
So obviously the more students, the more people studying, the better for society in general, really, for this level.
Yes, yes. I think it goes without saying, it might be a cliche, but I strongly believe in it, that a person that has been educated, in other words, vocational, bachelor's, master's, and indeed a PhD, is going, a person with a degree is going to be a better person. And for a PhD researcher, who of course will know a lot in depth about a very specific subject, we might miss those skills and competencies that that person will carry to the workplace once they complete the study. And perhaps more importantly than that, and I like to emphasize this point, is that we expect our researchers to abide by a code of conduct about research integrity. Researchers have to be honest. Researchers have to respect others and the resources with which they work. To have a person with a PhD working in a company, even if it's not related to the research conducted, but the person brings or takes to the company a brilliant mind that can analyze, synthesize, discuss, etc., but is can foster an ethos of integrity in that company, in a school, in a hotel, if you're running the show there and providing something special to your clients, I think that is something that we really need to flag. It's extremely, extremely important, and we should be ready to pay for something like that.
Okay, but how do people decide, or, you know, do you coerce people into wanting to do a PhD, or is it like, oh, I want to do this? Now, it could be, you know, in some fields, it's almost the obvious next step to do, but are there PhD students that you kind of want to pull in, or can people just approach you and say, hi, I want to do this, I have no idea where to start, could you help at that level? So what background do people need?
Usually the researcher completes a degree, a bachelor's, often, and that is a good thing, they complete a master's program, either at the university here or elsewhere, and if they have they have a bug for doing something else, what next? And the PhD is obviously the next thing to do. And they often approach, or indeed can be approached, by an academic they have worked with. And it starts off that way, because of course you have to have an idea. Now, sometimes it is the academic who gives the idea, or the beginnings of an idea, and then you see whether you can run with it for a few months to see whether you can come up with a research proposal, or else the student can come up with the idea himself or herself, approach a person at the university, somebody they worked with or not, as the case may be, and see whether that idea can be taken forward for doctorate research. Very often is the student who carries a lot of the enthusiasm, but of course that enthusiasm needs to be well received and be allowed to flourish, which is what faculties usually do, and institutes, etc., to attract research. And of course the research has to be not of local significance only, because a criterion for being awarded PhD, the research has to be a significant contribution to knowledge, and it has to be original. So it is not sufficient to say, you know, nobody has done this thing in Malta, because it could be an interesting case study, yes, but usually what happens is that researchers, students, will look at the method of study and be able to contribute to the general field by being able to reflect on the about the case study and contribute to the field in that manner. In other words, they are introspective.
So is it, how do people check? Because, you know, when you do marketing research, for example, you Google stuff and you can see if anyone's used the same line or that kind of thing. Is there like a database of PhDs?
You can use a database of PhDs, but I mean, with the World Wide Web and everything at your fingertips, a student who wants to do a PhD will already have learnt at bachelor's and master's level, how you can zoom in to see whether a particular research question, whether it has been tackled, and if it has been tackled, whether there is still scope for taking the research forward still. And that is usually where having an academic who will you bounce your idea off will help you determine whether yes, there could be a research idea, there's something original.
So do you have to register the idea once you've got it, so that other people can find out that there's something already being worked on? So Julia, you're working on something within the cancer research field. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously, you know, everyone wants to cure every type of cancer, so there must be a lot of research going on. How do you hone in on the subject that you're tackling, which is something to do with neuroblastoma, which I'm going to ask you to explain to us, okay. But how did you get to that point, and how do you find that no one else is doing what you're doing?
So I can start by explaining what neuroblastoma is.
Thank you.
So neuro refers to nerves, mm-hmm. and blastoma refers to cancers that start off from immature or developing cells.
Okay.
And because of this, because they develop from immature or developing cells, it's a type of cancer that develops in children as well.
Oh, okay.
So that was an aspect of the project that interested me. And in my case, my supervisor issued the project and the interest in carrying out research on this type of cancer. And it was a project that intrigued me because I felt that it's an area that we can start to make a difference in if it's successful. And I applied for the project and was accepted for it. So in my case, that was how I got into the project. But then when you're starting off and you're investigating and seeing what research has already been done, there is a medical database of articles. It's called PubMed. And basically you start reading
uh-huh.
about what has been done and what has worked and what chemicals they've used. And that's how you discover that there is either a gap or there hasn't been much development or much improvement in the treatment options. And because of that, that is why it was such an important project to
be able to do.
Yes.
Okay, and you have studied, you're studying locally.
Yes.
On a full-time basis.
Yes.
So how much time is it taking from you? Because you're still working as well.
Yes, yes, I work part-time.
Yeah.
Well, you cannot really assign a specific amount of time to it. Many times, because it's laboratory-based and experiment-based, they don't always work straight away. You have to optimize protocols, and after you optimize, then you can check whether your experiment is working and whether the chemicals that you're using to see whether they have an effect on the cells are actually having an effect. So,
and you have to do that repeatedly, I guess, to absolutely be certain.
Yes, first you have to do the optimization so that you know that when you detect something, it's because it's an actual effect, not because it's a fluke in your experimental method. That's why the optimization is so important. And that's why sometimes you can't predict how long it's going to take you, yes.
But we were discussing earlier how with a medical type PhD, it has to be done within a particular time frame because obviously science and things move on so rapidly.
Yes.
When did you start yours and when's your planned finish?
I started in 2017,
okay.
in June, and my plan is to finish September 2022.
Okay, so the end is nigh.
The end is near. Hopefully.
I obviously want to ask you if we can cure this, but I'll probably guess we have to wait until the...
You have to wait.
Okay, we'll wait a bit. So we'll ask you about that. And Roberto, you're doing quite an interesting one, actually. It almost seems obvious that in terms of... Because you're a medical doctor, mm-hmm. and then you've done your first degree on... environment and human.
Yes, exactly. And for my master's degree in public health, I had studied climate change and human health, the public perceptions of climate change and human health, which was quite innovative at the time because that's back in 2007.
Ah, so you see, now it seems obvious, but then it would
back
have
then,
been.
Yes, yeah. WHO was putting the argument forward that the impacts of climate change are not only on polar bears, but they're also on humans.
Mm.
So we were still at that stage at the time. So the interest was there for a long time. And actually my area of special interest in public health is environmental health. So I represent the country at WHO committees and boards.
Okay.
On climate change, on biodiversity loss, anything related to environmental health, air pollution. The interest, I became more enthusiastic about the global ecological crisis because the thesis is about that. When I read a book by Jackson, which was called Prosperity Without Growth, and I was intrigued by the subject, that was in 2010. But then I got married and had children, so I had to postpone my PhD plans.
But you've managed to fit it in. You've got three children and you work. So how do you... Sorry, there are so many people like, oh, you know, no, I'd love to do that. And somebody pointed out something, or somebody posted something the other day, which has just resonated with me. It says, one day or day one. So there must have been the one day where you're like, oh, one day I'm going to do that. And then all by sudden it was day one, I'm going to start.
Yes, there was a day one, which was in 2018 when I officially started the PhD. But there is, in my case, there was a process before the PhD. It can take a while because I was examining different areas where I could pursue the PhD, different universities, in which department. So before arriving at the Department of Philosophy, I was looking at the Department of Economics, because economics has a role in the global ecological crisis. I was looking at other institutes as well.
Okay, and then not just locally, you spread your wings and looked overseas as well?
Yes, I was looking at the University of Surrey, which is where Tim Jackson, the author who wrote the book, lectures. But they wanted me to do it on campus, and I couldn't do that.
So you were able to do your study remotely with a remote university and also locally? How does that work?
Well, there's a process. So you have to apply and then you have to be accepted. In Malta, I applied with the Department of Philosophy. Yes, and I was accepted here.
And then you find another university to help with backing up, with support.
And then, yes, that was one of the conditions, because the university is small and the degree of expertise at the university is limited. So my particular subject, I was asked to look for an external supervisor from a university abroad, and that was another journey in itself, looking for an external supervisor.
So there's a lot of research to do. Research, yes. You know, it's not you can't just focus on your subject. So Nicholas, is that something again that your unit helps with, finding, you know, which universities have the strength in which subjects?
As the director of the doctoral school, I sit on a committee which vets what recommendations come from faculties. So really and truly the hard work already happens before it comes to us. What I do is, for instance, make sure that for co-supervision duties, we have started paying a small honorarium to external appointees, because before it was not done. So I fought tooth and nail on giving something, because like that we ensure that we can ask co-supervisors from abroad to give us a resume of what they have been doing over here. So this is not something that is being done simply for the pleasure of doing it, but because I am giving an honorarium, then I have to convince the finance director that the money is well spent. And that is where we come in.
Mm-hmm.
But as Roberto said, it is absolutely normal to have to seek co-supervisor or supervisors, depending on the nature of the research, from abroad. This allows both the supervisor and the student to be drawn into a larger research family, a larger research network.
Okay.
And this is something that that is becoming more and more common. Of course, the challenge is for the students to ensure that supervisory meetings or tutorial meetings are actually happening, involving three or more individuals. But of course, there's no excuse, because now we have digital technological platform, which worked brilliantly during the pandemic, and we can use that. Which doesn't mean that the student should not travel abroad, for instance, to present the work that is being done to this academic and his or her own students.
Okay.
Because testing ideas before the big day, which is the submission of the thesis and the defense, should be a continuous process. You should not hide away from sharing what you have been doing, because I'd rather be examined in front of a friendly audience than wait for the big day.
And have that one question that you've not answered, or exactly. you've maybe just had mild arrogance to, like, oh, no, I know this. And then somebody comes out with something you haven't considered because you didn't turn left and ask somebody else. But so, for example, in your case, Julia, cancer, I'm imagining, because I really know nothing, will affect different ethnic backgrounds as well. It's not just about your normal, would it affect somebody from Australia differently to somebody from Africa, differently from someone to, is there a genetic difference, or it's not like that, doesn't work like that? So do you have to travel to do your research, or is it all lab based?
No, I mean, in my case, my project involves growing these type of cancer cell in a in a laboratory. So when you're doing, when you're at preclinical research, you use a cell line, which is the type of cancer, and it continues to multiply and continues to grow in culture.
So it's it rather than human. Okay.
It would have been taken from a patient originally, and then they modify it so that it can continue to grow in culture. And that way you're growing it in a controlled environment, and that way you're able to see or measure if there are any changes when you apply anything to it. But to answer your question about the genetics, there is a genetic predisposition to cancer, but in the case of cancers such as neuroblastoma, which happen due to a change during the development of the cancer, it's more of a random a random change.
So even more unfair.
Yes, even more.
I really hope you've got the answer. So I'll just
there would be genetic predispositions that make you more likely to have that mutation, but it is what it is. It's a mutation. That's why it occurs in children and not from exposure to toxins, for example, that cause mutations in DNA.
We couldn't. You and Roberto haven't got anything in common on this line in terms of your environmental.
In my case, I'm looking more at the macro level. I mean,
what's in the sea?
It could like climate change and if more on the ozone and exposure to the sun, that can increase your likelihood of developing skin cancer, for example. But children don't get skin cancer because they haven't been exposed to
so long
to the harmful effects of radiation, for example. It's more of a mutation.
Yes, in my case, for my thesis, I'm looking more about the politics and economics of the global ecological crisis. So I'm not really looking at the science.
Okay.
Even though my background is medical, which is one of the reasons why I'm pursuing it with the Department of Philosophy, because that was a place where I could do it. And the nature of the thesis is conceptual in nature as well.
Okay.
So I'm using empirical evidence. And but I'm not generating new empirical evidence for my thesis.
Okay.
That was a bit of a challenge for me, because I was used to the scientific method in medical school and for my master's degree in public health, which takes the form of an introduction, a methods, results, and discussion and conclusion kind of format. In this case, with the Department of Philosophy, I can have a kind of format which takes like 6 or 7 chapters.
Wow, okay.
Yes, which doesn't follow that kind of rationale.
So it's learning, literally learning how to present as well as you go along. It's not just knowing,
exactly
what to do. It's a complete change of...
Yes, every department has its own traditions. It has its own way of doing things. And but I find it challenging. I find it's an experience. I also believe that learning is a lifelong education, lifelong process. So pursuing a PhD was a way of structuring my aptitude for research. And I started it 1 year after the PhD school was instituted. So I'm lucky about that, because I didn't know before this program that it was in 2017 that the school had started operating. But I find the program extremely helpful, and I want to the 3 minutes presentation, I think, that's really a good one. I want to
enroll.
I intend to enroll, yes, for that
in
point.
In fact, I've got a few people I'd like to enroll in that might not be doing PhDs. So it's been fascinating. We're actually going to continue talking in part two, which will air next week. Been talking to Nicholas Vella, Julia Vassallo-Eminien, and also Roberto De Bono. So hang fire. Till next week, we're going to talk some more about these fascinating subjects of doing a PhD. Thank you for joining me on this week's A Degree of Interest.